You know, when the Bolsheviks came to power in 1917, they aspired to scientific government, as they called it, that would eradicate centuries of bad policies based on tradition, superstition, elitism, etc. And it started off quite hopefully with science at its heart. Under Stalin in particular, science received enormous great dollops of funding, and when he died, the Soviet Union had the most generously funded scientific establishment in the world. But as you are about to hear, the close ties between science and the state had mixed results. At its best, it took, yes, the first bloke into space, and at its worst, it brought starvation and death to millions. My next guest has explored this fraught relationship between science and the state in his new book. Simon Ings, I-N-G-S, is the author, and it's called Stalin and the Scientist, A History of Triumph and Tragedy. And Simon joins us from London. Simon, welcome to LNL, or as I frequently call it because of its perceived political bias, Leninel.
Hello.
I understand that you were inspired to write this work by the life of Alexander Luria. Tell us about him.
Luria was a remarkable psychologist who went from discipline to discipline as a way of surviving the Stalinist period. He began as a developmental psychologist. He went on to become the godfather of neuropsychology. He came up with the first really good modern understanding of how the systems of the brain work together. And I was inspired by him because he was also, is also, the father of modern popular science. He wrote a couple of books which were translated quite early on. One called Man with a Shattered World, about a Soviet soldier dealing with a catastrophic brain injury. And another, which is perhaps better known, called Mind of a Nemenist, about a man who could simply not forget and became a stage memory man in order to make a living, but had huge trouble in his life because he could simply not forget anything. And I was inspired by these stories when I was, 13, 14, I think I came across them. And I came across another obsessive, another Luria obsessive who said, well, let's do a biography. But what I found was that Luria's great achievement was to lead a relatively normal life, which of course is terrible for a biographer. And what I ended up doing was writing a book about why that was an exceptional thing to achieve. So in the attempt to write about Luria, talk about mission creep, I ended up talking about the whole of Soviet science over a 60-year period.
What was the state of science in the Tsarist era?
It's a very strange sort of split personality for Russian science. They have extraordinary individuals and achievements. We think of Mendeleev's Table of the Elements is a classic example. Lesser known people include Doguchev, who created more or less single-handedly created modern soil science, which sounds slightly strange unless you're a farmer, in which case you rely on it. On the other hand, there were no real institutions aside from the one set up by Peter the Great called the Academy of Sciences. There were no university science departments worth the name. There was a huge reliance upon Western tradition and a very strong anxiety that there was no homegrown scientific base to draw upon, despite the fact that the nation was and is incredibly rich in raw materials. So the Soviet attempt to fund science in a more grandiloquent way than anyone else had ever done in the world before, or indeed since, was about trying to harness Russian raw materials for the benefit of the state. So one can understand the appeal. It wasn't simple grandiosity. It was an attempt to take what was potentially a rich country and actually make it rich.
One of the raw materials that they wanted to get organized was human semen. Let me ask you now about Ivanov, who you see as a sort of emblem for Soviet science.
His story in its details is quite an outlier, but it does convey the a combination of naivety and talent and dread, which seems to run through the whole account. Ivanov was already an international celebrity when the Bolsheviks came to power. He was a leading light in the development of artificial insemination. And he was able to produce 10 times as many horses as you would get by giving a stallion a good time. Now, this is tremendously important when most of your all your energy on a farm is horsepower, literal horsepower. This is before the days of tractors. Now, when the Bolsheviks came to power, of course, he lost his usual patrons. And so he needed to come up with a project that would inspire funding from the Soviet state. And so he had his research assistant look into the crossing of humans and other primates. Now, he'd been doing this sort of thing for years.
Well, looking at the outcome of the American election, that seems to have been successful.
I think so. In fact, the Americans were very keen on this project, and there were individual funders, newspaper editors, and so on, who were very keen and wanted and actually offered to provide Ivanov with money for his expeditions to Kindia to attempt the cross. The KKK got wind of it and wrote threatening letters, so that funding was never available. But there was European funding. Parisian funding was quite considerable. And so he actually attempted the cross. Nothing came of it, and we now know why that cross between a human and a chimpanzee is not possible. There are various technical reasons why it's not possible. But on the face of it, it was a reasonable experiment to attempt. What was less than reasonable was the fact that having failed to impregnate female chimpanzees, he went on to attempt impregnating female African women. That in itself is not a problem, because when he went back to the Soviet Union, plenty of women volunteered for the opportunity to take part in this scientific experiment. What happened in Africa, though, is that he didn't actually tell people what he was doing. As a consequence, the Academy of Sciences disowned him, and his project was taken up by the Communist Academy, a Bolshevik rival to the Academy of Sciences, at precisely the moment when negative eugenics was sweeping the Western world, particularly the United States, particularly Germany. And as a consequence, a generation of far-sighted Soviet geneticists got it in the neck because they were tarred with the fascist brush, essentially.
The pin-up boy of Soviet science, as I recall, was the so-called barefoot scientist Lysenko. Tell us about him.
Trofim Lysenko was actually quite a talented young chap. He'd got his education by mail order, essentially. He was the son of a peasant. And he ended up doing some really quite good studies on how to regulate the growth of peas and beans under different temperatures. The Leningradskaya Pravda liked the idea of this barefoot scientist doing very good experiments on the basis of having learned through a correspondence course. And so they wrote this fantastic puff piece about him, in which they first called him a barefoot scientist and were holding him up as the figure of the future of Soviet science, a genuine citizen science, a genuinely egalitarian scientist.
And of course, being a Lamarckian, it sort of was ideologically okay.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he had inherited ideas about the plasticity of growing things. The Lamarckian idea is essentially that if a giraffe has to stretch to the top of a tree to pluck leaves off the top of the tree, its children will have longer necks. Now, this was entirely an entirely conventional belief at the time. Lots of really good people who were later convinced by the genetic explanation were card-carrying Lamarckians. Lysenko could have been one of them, but this puff piece actually did his head in. He never did proper science again. He never bothered to learn any mathematics. He fell in with a philosopher who was also a mathematical illiterate, and they held to an earlier and frankly rather badly understood version of Lamarckism in order to defend their institutional position. So what appears to be an argument over the science is really an argument over how you get the paycheck at the end of the week. Lysenko and his philosopher friend Isaac Present, who is a truly nasty piece of work, ran roughshod over developing Soviet genetics in order to maintain a position that they didn't really deserve because they were not actually very good.
And of course, Lysenko would regularly denounce competitors.
Lysenko and Present both were unforgivably unpleasant towards their colleagues. But, you know, it's very tricky as a writer of a history of this period to get the balance right, because the fact is nobody wants to be sent to the gulag for no reason. No one wants to see their uncle or their father or their mother or their brother die in a concentration camp for no reason, and they will come up with an explanation that actually gives some dignity to the victim. And so there is the assumption that people died because they believed in classical genetics or because they believed in child psychology or whatever the field happens to be. Quite often, these people were denounced, were sacked, were exiled, were thrown into camps, or indeed were shot simply because they had the wrong patrons, simply because they had the wrong friends. And so picking apart the politics and the science in this period is difficult because, of course, the Marxist project was to create a scientific government. There shouldn't have been a slip of paper that you could slip between the two disciplines. And that makes the work of explaining the period really quite hard.
We were talking about some of the people around Putin, in fact, up to and including Putin, who have got fake PhDs lately. And now there are Putinist revisionists, perhaps armed with fake PhDs, trying to rewrite this guy's, Lysenko's, place in history.
It's really quite extraordinary to call Lysenko... well, what they say, there are a couple of politically motivated academics who actually do have real degrees and really should know better, who are basically trying to say that Lysenko, in believing in the plasticity of living forms, was an early epigeneticist who has been badly misunderstood. Epigenetics is the science of how the environment regulates gene expression. Now, this is rather like saying that someone who believes in mermaids is a marine biologist. It's unforgivably silly to make this argument. And it's bitterly ironic because actually the Soviet Union, the early Soviet Union, had a handful of individuals who'd come up through the Lamarckian tradition, who had looked at classical genetics as it was being developed by Thomas Hunt Morgan in the United States, and said, well, this is amazing and this is great, but it's not the whole story, and the environment must actually regulate the expression of these genes. So they were epigeneticists, and they were thrown out of their jobs by Trofim Lysenko. Lysenko destroyed an incredible potential tradition of epigenetics in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but to be fair, he did grow lemons in the Arctic Circle for Stalin.
Oh, Stalin loved lemons. Lemons were an obsession of Stalin's. They became his only hobby, actually. He would have hothouses built at the back of each of his dashes so that he could go out and prune them. You have to understand that even before the revolution, it was painfully aware to Dokuchiev, the founder of soil science and so on, that Russia could not feed itself. It only has a relatively narrow band of black earth in which crops can grow. Outside of that, it's actually quite dry and it's quite barren. So the potential of crops to grow outside that band, for crops to be plastic, for you to be able to breed crops to behave in a different way, was tremendously appealing. And it wasn't just the eccentrics of the time who wanted to believe that Trofim Lysenko's theories of vernalization would work. There were hugely significant scientists and bureaucrats of the time who were desperate to have their collections of useful plants extended so that they could, and developed so that they could grow in the far north.
These days, of course, we have any number of GM people wreaking havoc or miracles or both. I think to understand the importance of science to the Soviet, you have to remind us about the significance of famines in Russian history.
We have good records of Russian food production since about 800. And the reason we have those records is because it was so vitally important that to the Russian people and to the Russian government that they somehow deal with regular famines. The failed liberal revolution of 1905 was triggered largely by the development of a liberal protest movement that was created around 1891, around a terrible famine then. The Civil War was followed by a famine. There were two famines in the 1930s. There was a very bad famine that was hidden from the West for years, shortly after the Second World War. The difficulty of feeding people was absolutely extraordinary, and it justified policies of Stalin, where he basically took food away from the Ukraine in order to feed the Russians and starve the Ukraine to the tunes of tens of millions.
LNL, or LNL online on your mobile. We're talking to Simon Ings, journalist and author of a new book called Stalin and His Scientists. Simon, let's talk about another of the popular Soviet scientists, a woman who was awarded Joe's Prize for her work on species formation.
You mean Olga Lepeshinskaya?
Attempting to pronounce it.
Well, I hope I'm pronouncing her right. She was an absolute sweetie, but a lunatic. She was a friend of Lenin's, a friend of Stalin's. She would quite happily say boo to power. She was very highly placed and all round a good egg. She was very interested in the orphan problem that followed the Civil War, campaigned for orphans to be, for the rights of orphans, institutions to be set up to look after them. She actually adopted half a dozen of them herself and brought them up. She was generally very highly regarded, but as a scientist, she was an absolute disaster. She got obsessed with the idea.
Mate, come on. She discovered that baking soda would reverse the aging process. Surely she deserves both the Stalin and the Nobel Prize for that.
Well, you know, there's eccentricity and then there's fraud, and she tipped from one to the other quite catastrophically. Having decided that soda baths would rejuvenate the old, she then became obsessed with the idea of the vital substance, and so she was grinding up beetroot seeds, beetroot plants in a pestle in order to demonstrate that any part of the plant would germinate. Finally, she resorted to taking an egg, taking some of the white of an egg, putting it under a microscope and filming the result. And the result, of course, is that the egg rots and the cells fall apart.
Forgive me for interrupting, but I have to read what you wrote. It's so good. She had been filming the death and decomposition of cells, then running her film backwards through the projector.
Yes, and she was awarded a Stalin Prize for the effort. Songs were written about her. I've yet to track down the songs. Anyone who knows the songs, please get in touch. There were plays written about her, poems, school competitions, there were statues. And it was at this point in the development of the decay, depending on which way you want to look at it, of the Stalin estate, this was the point at which, in almost every area, the connection between government and truth had entirely fallen apart. And government was being run according to a set of myths, a set of founding fathers, having created the state. And so all scientific knowledge was by then being used as a blunt weapon to defend Stalin's position as despot over the Soviet Union.
Well, let's now talk briefly about some of the triumphs. The atomic program, there's a delusion in the West that they built the bomb completely as a consequence of Western spies, but that wasn't true, was it?
It's simply not true. There is I did come across a wonderful account regarding Fuchs, the famous spy who is best, ought to be known and ought to be celebrated for having contributed to the atomic bomb projects of three separate nations, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union. Fuchs was famously spied for the Soviet Union, but quite often he was passing data that he himself was coming up with. And there was no doubt on the Allied side towards the end of the war that the Soviets were capable of building a bomb. And historically, that has been borne out. We know that they were capable of doing so. And so there is a wonderful account of a casual conversation in Los Alamos, in which American nuclear physicists, including Oppenheimer, believe it or not, are saying, well, the Russians are bound to get the bomb sooner or later, and it's really important that we stop the Germans as fast as possible before they get the bomb. So why don't we just pass this data to the Soviet Union? And everyone's sitting around with their beers going, yeah, we might as well give the Ruskies all this data. They're going to get it anyway. And the only person not to be taking part in this conversation is Klaus Fuchs, bless his heart, who's sitting very quietly in the corner of the room. Because, of course, this is precisely what he is doing.
The space program also deserves a quick detour.
The space program is outside the period of the book I was working on, and this is a peculiar situation for me slightly, because the space program was spectacularly successful. It's the most reliable space program on Earth, has been for years. Most of the its projects were stunningly successful. Where it did trip up now and again was the Soviet habit, and indeed the post-Soviet habit, of never having one institution to do anything. You always have to have two, and they always have to hate each other. So they were, you know, days away of landing on the moon. Days away of landing from landing on the moon. They've had more experience in space, more, you know, long stays in space than any other nation. Their technology is more reliable. It is a fantastic story. It develops out of the specialist gulags, the specialist prisons that the Soviet state developed in the 30s and that were continued into the 40s. That kind of military-industrial complex that was developed actually out of a prison system is the slightly dodgy result of the Stalinist government, and it did make the Soviet space program possible.
I had an astronaut on the program, an American astronaut, the other day, who was being very generous in his praise for Russian space science. Anyway, look, Simon, you've done the story proud. Simon Ng's book is called Stalin and the Scientist, A History of Triumph and Tragedy, published, and we should add, I think, to that, in the light of Simon's anecdotes, Triumph, Tragedy and Stand-Up Comedy, published by Faber and Faber. Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you so much.